Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts, and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. We start by looking at the bestseller lists on Amazon.co.uk and the Sunday Times and seeing what new entries there are this week. Then we'll be chatting to Ferdi Alenan. He was born in Dublin to an Irish mother and a Libyan father. He holds a BA in History and Classics from University College Dublin. His debut novel, Glorious Exploits, is set in 412 BC, and Athens' invasion of Sicily has failed catastrophically. It has just won the 2024 Bollinger Everyman Woodhouse Prize for Comic Fiction and was described as a delightful mash of contemporary Irish comedy and classical Athenian tragedy. We also chat to Nina Saville, whose career spans theatre, film and television, showcasing her talents both on screen and behind the scenes as a producer. Her debut novel, a satire of celebrity culture, is called A Night with Damien Spurr. It follows a renowned thriller writer who leads a life filled with fame, but also inner turmoil as he embarks on a journey of self-discovery. The persona of Damien Spurr is loosely based on Nina's late husband, legendary British television director Philip Saville. And we chat to Aline Templeton, who grew up in Fife. She's worked in education and broadcasting and was a Justice of the Peace for 10 years. She's been a chair of the Society of Authors in Scotland and a director of the Crime Writers Association. Her latest novel, Deadfall, is book 6 in the D.I. Kelso Strang series set in Scotland. Just the first hour. In the second hour, we chat to Jade Beer, Helen Hawkins, Amy Pollack, and Deborah Fowler. And that's tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The pen's in my hand, ending unplanned. Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate.
Good evening. Welcome to The Book Show. As always, we start by looking at the Sunday Times bestseller list, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK and the one that every author wants to be on. The chart is the most accurate and comprehensive estimation of book sales in the country. So will Richard Osman be the Christmas number one? The first instalment of his new thriller series, We Solve Murders, last week sold more than double the next best-selling hardback novel. Or will his fellow cosy crime aficionado, the Reverend Richard Coles, boosted by his appearance on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, seize the top spot? We will see. Looking at general hardbacks, just one new entry this week. At number one, I Haven't Been Entirely Honest With You by Miranda Hart. Number two, Diddly Squat, Home to Roost by Jeremy Clarkson. Number three is The Memoir Part One by Cher. Number four, Unleashed by Boris Johnson. Number 5, All That Matters by Chris Hoy. Number 6, Ted, A Porter Biography by Ted the Dog. Number 7 is that new entry. It's called Into the Uncut Grass by Trevor Noah and Sabina Hahn, an illustrated fable about a child's journey into the world beyond the shadow of home. Number 8 is Finding the Edge by Jimmy Anderson. Number 9, The Book of Gifts by Lucy Claire Dunbar. And number 10 is This Time Next Year by David Jason. Looking at fiction hardbacks, there are no new entries from last week. At number 1, We Solve Murders by Richard Osman. Number 2, In Too Deep by Lee Child and Andrew Child. Number 3, The Hotel Avocado by Bob Mortimer. Number 4 is Intermezzo by Sally Rooney. Number 5, Murder Under the Mistletoe by Richard Coles. Number 6, Killing Time by Alan Bennett. Number 7, Precipice by Robert Harris. Number 8, Midnight and Blue by Ian Rankin. Number 9 is Odyssey by Stephen Fry. And number 10, Guilty by Martina Cole and Jackie Rose. Moving on to Amazon.co.uk, the top 10 still at number 1 is Guinness World Records 2025. Number 2, We Solve Murders by Richard Osman. Number 3, I can't believe this is still in the bestseller chart, so I have to keep saying it, Things to Do While You Poo on the Loo, activity book with funny facts, bathroom jokes, poop, puzzles, Sudoku and much more by Alex Smart. Yes, thanks, Alex. Number 4 is The 1% Club, a quiz book for all the family as seen on TV. That's by BBC Studios. Number 5 is Orbital, which is the winner of the Booker Prize 2024. That's by Samantha Harvey. Number 6, Squirrel's Snowman, a festive lift the flap story. This is for toddlers. It's book 6 in the Acorn Wood series by Julia Donaldson. Number 7 is Murdle, which is these murder mystery logic puzzles by G.T. Carber. Number 8, Simply Jamie, Fast and Simple Food by Jamie Oliver. Number 9, Board of Lunch, 6 Ingredient Slow Cooker by Nathan Anthony. And number 10, Things I Can't Say Out Loud in Meetings. This is a lined journal with quotes, but it's in the top 10 and it's by Taylor A. Wilde.
You're listening to The Book Club on Talk Radio Europe. And keep listening. That's an instruction from Margaret Thatcher.
Joining us on the line now is Ferdi Lennon. He was born in Dublin to an Irish mother and Libyan father. He holds a BA in History and Classics from University College Dublin and an MA in Prose Fiction from the University of East Anglia. He's with us on the book show to talk about his debut novel, Glorious Exploits, set in 412 BC and Athens invasion of Sicily has failed catastrophically. Thousands of Athenian soldiers are held captive in the quarries of Syracuse, starving, dejected, and hanging on by the slimmest of threads. It has just won the 2024 Bollinger Everyman Woodhouse Prize for Comic Fiction, and it was described as a delightful mash of contemporary Irish comedy and classical Athenian tragedy. Welcome to the book show, Ferdia.
Thank you so much for having me, Hannah.
Oh, it's great to have you. And congratulations on this award.
Yeah, thanks a million. I mean, I was stunned. It's a prize that I've followed for years. So you kind of secretly hope that you might get shortlisted, but winning was something I kind of hadn't dared hoped.
Oh, amazing. So what does it kind of mean to you? What effect do you hope or think that winning the award will have?
World domination, hopefully.
Brilliant.
The award has a great history. Like there's some between the shortlists and the different writers who've won it. So it's great to be kind of included in the last year with Bob Mortimer, the year before that Percival Everett's Trees, magnificent novel. So it's just, it's lovely to be part of that, tradition. Prize.
Absolutely. So your book, why did you decide to set it in this period of history?
I've always loved and been fascinated by ancient Greek mythology, ancient Greek history. I studied it in university and I studied the classics in university. And there's a particularly amazing, the history of the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta. And in this, there's a section where Athens invades Sicily, and it's this wild escapade that they think is going to be a very quick conquest. Whereas in actual fact, they lose so badly. It's such a catastrophic defeat that it essentially ends Athens as an imperial power. So it's almost like the Sicilian expedition is almost like a Greek tragedy about Athens' ambition. I knew I wanted to write about it, wasn't sure what my angle would be. And then I read in Plutarch these amazing lines about how Athenian prisoners who really were kept in these limestone quarries outside of Syracuse, because there were so many prisoners, they couldn't fit them anywhere else. And actually some of these Athenian prisoners survived by quoting lines from Euripides' plays. So with this strange contradiction where the Athenians were hated would-be invaders, but there was a deep love of Athenian drama, almost like, you know, Hollywood today, etc.
Mm.
This was popular entertainment. And I knew I wanted it when I read those lines about, prisoners of war having to perform Greek tragedies to survive. I was just like, okay, that's my story. I need to write about this.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a great story, an interesting story, but not amazingly funny. How have you added your kind of Irish humor to it to make it funny?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think in one way you could approach the subject matter as very dark, and it is very dark, but there's almost an absurdism. I think to me, even that scenario of prisoners performing Greek tragedies to survive, it's very sad, but it's poignant, but there's also an absurdism there too, which I found interesting. I found all those elements drew me to it. And it's about, like anything, I think it's about the character. My book is narrated by this unemployed Syracusan potter called Lampo, who's a bit of a chancer, a bit of a likely lad. And maybe the way that he almost operates within this novel or sees things, almost as if he's in a comedy. You know, he's just very delighted that Syracuse has won, and, you know, he's got nothing much to do because he's lost his job. So he and his friend go down to the quarry for a bit of entertainment. So I think the humor comes from the perspective, you know?
Yeah.
It comes from the character.
Absolutely. And, because we're talking such a way away in history, obviously you studied classics, which obviously would have helped, but how do you kind of put yourself in their situation and imagine what it would have been like to be around during this time?
Wikipedia is very helpful. but seriously, very important was the idea of, and it's such a, as you say, it's such the distant past, but we actually have a lot of words from people in this period. So we've got a lot of Greek drama. We've got a lot of like tragedy, the comedies, the philosophy, histories. So I basically read everything that I could to get a sense of that ancient Greek mentality, how the people saw the world. And one of the interesting things I discovered was actually in the plays of Aristophanes. And these are the only contemporary plays, like set in the contemporary period. So unlike maybe Euripides or Homer, they're not about the myths. They're not about gods or Greek heroes. They're actually just about the ordinary people of the day, often. And in these plays, they're very bawdy. They're very sweary. There's lots of slang. If you read a modern translation, and I was like, oh, you know, our idea of ancient Greece as this very formal, you know, characters stepping out of the set of Downton Abbey is it's a very limited idea. And if I can find another way into this material that will be unexpected, funny, but also actually in some ways quite true. So that was part of the process, just reading lots of stuff from the period.
Yeah. And do you think people will be able to relate in some way to some of the characters, not necessarily what they're going through, obviously, but I mean, the interesting thing that even though so much has changed in history since then with technology and so many other things, people and their kind of basic needs and desires haven't necessarily changed that much.
That's exactly it. You know, human technology and culture has obviously transformed massively, but the human mind is the same operating system. And it's why I think great writers, Shakespeare, the, you know, Homer, Euripides, all of these different writers who were operating in a completely different system of thought or technology, etc., you can still read them and the work will resonate. You know, in my novel, the actual what is happening might seem very alien, but beneath the surface, themes of war, it's also very much about friendship. It's about art, it's about drama, comedy. So I think these are the through lines. And one of the things that I noticed, for example, reading Aristophanes' comedies, was they really reminded me of Monty Python, actually. So these 2,500 years old, but very funny. And yeah, I could imagine John Cleese kind of stepping into the role and some of them.
Yeah. So the fact that this is your first novel, when did you kind of come up with the idea for it? How long had you been planning it or writing it for?
It took me a long while, to be honest. I was writing for years. I had to do a bit of on the ground research. So when I started the novel, I'd never been to Greece. I'd never been to Sicily. I visited the quarries where this novel takes place. I visited Athens, traveled around Greece. I did a lot of research. So it took me, I would say, I there was a long break in between, you know, where I was doing different things, but yeah. I would say well over like between the first line and when I probably sent it off, I think it was like nearly 7 years.
Mm.
Now there were gaps in between, but yeah, it's it was a long and winding road, definitely. Yeah.
So does it feel weird now that it's out there, a kind of mixture of emotions?
It is. It's a strange thing. You know, writing is very solitary. You're in your own head and then letting go of it and hoping that people will respond to it, hoping that it will be, you know, hoping that it will actually be published, first of all, mm-hmm. and then that people will respond to it and like to it. Yeah, so it's, you can be nervous making, but also it's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's
and I mean, one of the big things about winning an award like you've just done is that it brings the book to the forefront. You know, people will see it, will hear about it in a way that maybe they might not have done before, particularly as it's your debut.
That's it. I mean, you realize when you get published, there are so many books that get published, so many excellent books that get published. And it's awards are a great way for new writers or any... It's a great way for readers to discover writers. And there's an element of luck involved, of course, but there, yeah. It's a wonderful opportunity to win an award like this.
Yeah. And did you, obviously, you've with the studying of classics, it makes sense that you've written about this time period in history. But how about the comedy side of things? Was that a kind of obvious thing that you were going to bring to your book?
Yeah, in some way, I think comedy is almost like a way of that you see the world. I think I've often, it's my approach to the world is to see the funny side of things. I love a lot of comedy. For example, even cinema, like the film Whitnail and I by Bruce Robinson was a film that I loved.
Mm.
Monty Python growing up. There's some great, you know, lots of classic comedy, Don Quixote. The comedy's a bit, yeah, comedy's certainly a big influence. So you bring everything. It's also very Irish novel. One of the things that readers might find a bit surprising is these characters sound like they're contemporary dubs. So I've brought many of my own, you know, my background and my interests into the book.
Love it. Have they got Irish accents then? Have you made them sound Irish?
Yeah, basically. So
love it.
Yeah. The Syracusans, because Syracuse, you know, Sicily's an island. It was Greek speaking and part of that world, but a little bit different. It had been colonized before, so part of the Greek world, but at a distance. So I kind of used the Irish voice.
Yeah,
in that sense.
Brilliant. So now that the book is out there and it's won an award and everything, does that add a bit of pressure for book two, do you think?
I think at the moment I'm just going to rest on those laurels. no, of course, I'm sure it does in a way, but like that's it's kind of what you want, isn't it? You want people to enjoy the first novel and then anticipate the second, rather than kind of being like, oh no, I don't want to see what's next. So to me, it's a really good thing.
Yeah. And are you already thinking about book two, or are you going to take a bit of a break?
Oh yeah, I'm working away on book two now. So I'm a good bit into it actually.
Okay. Is it a similar setting?
It's historical. It's actually 14. It's historical fiction, but very different. And it is set in, it's during the Hundred Years' War in France. So kind of during the, also a very, you know, period of great upheaval.
Yeah.
It is invading, and France is not, let's say, doing very well at the time. So hopefully, you know, plague and mayhem and hopefully some chuckles.
Of course. Brilliant. Well, if people want to get a copy of Glorious Exploits, it has just won the 2024 Bollinger Everyman Woodhouse Prize for Comic Fiction. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Ferdia Lennon, who we've been chatting with today. Ferdia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Hannah. Lovely chatting to you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Nina Saville, whose career spans theatre, film and television, showcasing her talents both on screen and behind the scenes as a producer. She's with us on The Book Show to talk about her debut novel, which is a satire of celebrity culture. A Night with Damien Spurr follows a renowned thriller writer who leads a life filled with fame but also in a turmoil as he embarks on a journey of self-discovery. It's a romantic comedy tinged with darkness, delving into the tumultuous realm of unrequited love. The persona of Damien Spurr is loosely based upon Nina's late husband, legendary British television director Philip Saville. Welcome to The Book Show, Nina.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us, and congratulations, your debut novel must be very exciting.
Extremely exciting and very nerve-wracking.
Oh, is there a lot of you in it, is there? I mean, you've put a lot of love into it.
A huge amount of love. It was a very long journey, but there were lots of people on the way who were willing to help me and support me. It was a long pregnancy, six years.
Oh.
6 years, and now I'm giving birth. Oh, God.
Hopefully it's over quickly.
Yes, it is, with a book launch tonight.
Oh, exciting.
But you know, it's funny how things come together. I've had a friend of mine called Sherry Lungi, who ever since I started writing the book has always been a wonderful ear. And then a few months ago, about 5 months ago, I went to stay with her because I had to have damp proofing in my place. And I call her the Mother Teresa of Chelsea, because I stayed with her for 3 months and 10 days. And she was wonderful because of her ear being so strong. We edited together and we, you know, threw out the pips and kept the cherries, and her patience was extraordinary. And it's wonderful to have friends like that. And I have another friend called Julie Midwinter, who's always supported me on the way, and others who I've actually written about, you know, in the acknowledgements of the book. I mean, good team. It's a good team.
Oh, that's lovely. Very lucky. So tell us a little bit about your late husband, his incredible career, Philip Saville, and how you've kind of incorporated some of him, certainly not all of him, but some of him, into the character of Damien Spurr.
Well, Philip was an inspiration, but the character is totally fictitious. I think Damien Spurr has the charm of Philip, and the intelligence and the power of Philip. Well, Philip, when I met Philip, I fell in love within half a second. I was auditioning for Dracula, for one of the parts of The Girls, and I met him, and this extraordinary, charismatic, beautiful creature went up the stairs with him, up the lift with him, and it was like going up to paradise. I thought this was great. And so I sat down and waited for my audition, and he had to audition somebody else first. And he came out, and he had lipstick all over his shirt. and all over his neck. And I said, excuse me, Mr. Saville, you've got lipstick all over you. He said, yes. He had a beautiful voice. He said, the actress was showing me how she could be a vampire. And so... and then I just, you know, he was a lot older than me. I mean, a lot older than me. But was he probably sowed all his oats before he met me, because he'd slept with everybody. And but by the time he got to me, he was exhausted. So he was the most wonderful man. And the interesting thing about this man, this specific man, is that although he was a feminist, you know, we worked together and so forth. Women wanted him. They were the predators. He never, ever, ever had to thrust himself on a woman, ever. And, you know, women can be just as bad as men. Yeah. And I think that this is Damien Spurr. Damien Spurr is a wonderful, kind man who is vulnerable. But the women, they all want him. But unfortunately, Damien... always, he's a kind of a must-have, can't-have man, and he goes for the wrong woman, the ice queen, and it breaks his heart. But we don't have to worry about him, because he's got a star above him, and he moves through the book, and his good soul prevails in the end.
Hmm. So tell us a little bit more about Damien, then, as a character and as a man.
Well, Damien is a character who is strong and powerful, but his weak side, his vulnerable side, which stems from his family, is the devil's holy trinity: drugs, sex, and alcohol. And he, even though he has a kind of innocence, he still delves into this dark, dark, dark path of doing things that most people that I know wouldn't normally do. Nothing like Philip, by the way. Philip was never like that. Anyway, so Damien, you know, he finds his way because he has the voice of reason in his head. His voice saves him. And I think that that's what Damien's about. He's witty. He helps women. He's a survivor, but also he's a fantastic writer. But I think it's the nature of celebrity. You see, we all think these people are sort of, well, not all of us, that, you know, that they're wonderful and they have fantastic lives. But they're all the same, really. They've all got the same vulnerabilities. You know, sometimes they're happy, sometimes they're not. And I think that's the nature of celebrity. It's very difficult being a celebrity and a well-known person, because you have to be the person that the press sees you, and you have to become the person in a way. And it's really a parallel life, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So that's my character. And he meets all these interesting women on the way. Really interesting woman. He meets a married woman who, you know, who's tries to seduce a married man. And, but she becomes his best friend. It's really, there are some very interesting characters in it. And I think that Damien led my story more than anything else. I let him lead me, lead me on the adventure.
Tell us about Lady Elizabeth. She wins a knight with him at a charity auction.
Oh,
I love that.
God, what a bitch. I mean, she is the ultimate ice queen. And, you know, it's meant to be a knight with Damien Spurr sort of talking about his books. No way. She's a seducer. She leads him into a riotous life. She's a terrible, terrible woman. And really, and that is his downfall, because she's, you know, after the first night, this is the ultimate must-have, can't-have woman. And really, she has a lover who she really wants, who's an Argentinian polo player. And she nearly breaks his heart, nearly. But he manages to see the light because the voice helps him. Mm-hmm. And finally, in the end, she's the one who gets destroyed, not him.
Oh, good.
And I think that Elizabeth is an archetypal wicked witch of the West. Horrible, horrible, horrible girl.
What about Sophie?
Beautiful. Ah, poor little Sophie. Well, Sophie's a very vulnerable person, and she's madly in love with this married man. And she's also a little bit, she's you know, into the alcohol. She's very beautiful and sort of so she, but the married man who she meets at an auction, right, is quite saintly in a way. And he doesn't want to, he's gentle. He doesn't want to seduce her, but she's dying for him. So one day, she puts Viagra in his minestrone soup. She invites him over and she seduces him, but he's never going to leave his wife. And finally, she sees the light. So it's really about everybody seeing the light in the end and not sort of, you know, being a masochist and seeing the reality, really. Yeah. You know, so many people, they think, oh, my God, yes, he's a married man, but I'm going to win him. And frankly, you know, sort of 90% of the time they don't. And they end up in a very, very torturous relationship for years and years. And it's not worth it, is it?
No. So now this book is out there. Are you having a bit of a break or are you already on to another one?
Give me a break. I actually did. I took one of the characters from the book and I've already, because he was a very strong character, he was an interesting character. His name's David Rose and he had the first proposal restaurant. This is all set pre-COVID, by the way. But his weakness was he was a gambler. So he's a very interesting man. And so I might extricate him. And what am I going to do now? Well, my family are over from Miami. And we've got the book launch tonight at the 22 Club, and it's going to be extremely lovely. And Debbie Wiseman's doing the music, the theme for Damien Spur at the beginning. And Debbie, who's did Wolf Hall, has done everything. Debbie's the most wonderful person and a great composer. Sherry Lunk is reading the first chapter, not chapter, reading the first segment. Then there's a Q&A, and I'm doing my chapter. And there's going to be about 70 or 80 people there. So it's quite a big event. Yeah. And then I'm going off to Miami for Christmas, thank God.
What a break. How lovely. Nice. Well, enjoy. Yeah. You deserve it.
Thank you. Well, it's so wonderful to think that you can reinvent yourself. When my husband passed away, I was sort of in a bit of a, in a cloud. I didn't know quite where I was going to go, what I was going to do. It wasn't that I was codependent on him, but he was my soulmate. We had a path together for 36 years. Mm. And then everything he taught me, it was weird. It was like a sign. Everything he taught me suddenly emerged. And I started writing the book. Oh. And it was years and years of that. So that was a wonderful thing. And I think he's up there somewhere looking down at me. And I think he probably would be very proud and think, she's a good girl. Aww. It's like, you know, lessons in chemistry, you know. I mean, that was her first book this year. And what a book.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy. I'm happy I've done it now.
Yeah. Lovely that you felt good. That a lot of the writing of the book had kind of come from things that he taught you. That's really nice. Maybe you channeled him a little bit.
I think I did. And I think I made him laugh. I mean, he was a moody bugger, but I think I brought some fun into his life. And I mean, you know, he said, I'll teach you the opera of writing. Well, he didn't say I'll teach you. He taught me the opera of the writing, you know, from the darkness to the light. And, but it did take a lot of work, by the way. I mean, you know, over and over again, reading it, refining it. It's like a master's in writing, 6 years, you know, but 36 years with him. I didn't have to go to a university. I had my Philip who helped me.
Yeah.
And we worked together a lot.
Well, yeah. I mean, during so that 6 years of writing, you would have been grieving at the same time. So it's pretty impressive to have put a book out there as well.
No, do you know something? I was incredibly grieving because how lucky was I to have had one successful marriage for 36 years with a man who I adored and he really adored me. And every day it was a reinvention. And he was such a lovely person. I couldn't have had a nicer man in the world, honestly, really. What a special man he was.
Aww,
and so handsome and sexy.
That's really beautiful to be able to say that. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's about love, the book, really.
Yeah.
It's really about love. I'm fed up of reading and hearing all these terrible things all the time. I wanted to write about something about real love.
Yeah.
You know, moving through and finding it.
Well, if people want to get a copy of A Night with Damien Spurr, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Nina Saville, who we've been chatting with today. Nina, thank you so much for joining us. Lovely to chat with you.
It was lovely to chat with you. Thank you very much, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Aline Templeton, who grew up in Fife. She's worked in education and broadcasting and was a Justice of the Peace for 10 years. She's been a chair of the Society of Authors in Scotland and a director of the Crime Writers Association. She's with us on the Book Show to talk about her latest novel, Deadfall. It is book 6 in the D.I. Kelso Strang series. Welcome to the Book Show.
Thank you very much, Hannah. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. So it sounds like you've been busy with all the different hats on over the years.
Well, it has actually been quite a busy life one way and another. But it's been very interesting. And the lovely thing about the book world is you get to meet so many interesting people. And that's one of the things I think I've enjoyed most.
Yeah. And so when did you start writing?
Well, my first novel was written when I was 6 on notepaper stitched together with yellow thread. And it was called The Adventure of Mr. Wiz and Mrs. Woz, who went off together to Paris for the weekend. And my mother kept it. And when I gave it to her, she read it and laughed till the tears came down her cheeks. And I think I was so discouraged that having had set up this fine romantic thing for these two people went off to Paris together for the weekend, thought that it should be funny. It was dreadful. with the result that I turned to crime.
Oh, so how long have you been writing crime novels now? Because you've written a few different series, haven't you?
I wrote several standalones, and then I did quite a long series, which was set in Galloway, which is the southwest of Scotland, lovely area, bypassed by the motorway, and you sort of go back in time to the way small towns used to be, and you can still find it as you go there. So I did that for quite a long time, but there were two problems. In the first place, my detective, rather like Rebus, my detective aged along with the books. And I could see that there was a line coming when she'd simply be too old to be what she was pretending to be. The other thing was there used to be a number of constabularies in Scotland, and quite suddenly it became Police Scotland. So there were no individual constabularies. And since my series was very much set up in an individual constabulary, that was discouraging. So I thought quite hard about how you cope when you actually sort of dismantle a system like that. And the idea, of course, was to save money, with the result that many small constabularies, which had dealt with an area before, now had really no serious detection support. So I invented the Serious Rural Crime Squad, which is simply called in when there is a serious crime in a rural area where there is very little backup police. And that was where I created my detective Kelso Strang.
Yeah, great. An interesting name as well, Kelso. I like it.
Well, I've heard it before. It's not terribly common. I suppose it comes from the town in the borders called Kelso. But I've always rather liked it as a name.
Yeah. So tell us about the area that you're from, where you live. Is it quite remote there?
No, absolutely.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
No, I come from the East Duke of Fife, which is about less than an hour from Edinburgh. And the town I grew up in, which is a fishing village, is only 10 miles from St. Andrews, so it's not really remote, and I haven't set any of my books there.
Okay, but you do. But all your books are set in Scotland.
They're all set in Scotland.
Lovely.
In various different parts.
Okay, so tell us a bit more about D.I. Kelso.
He'd been an army officer. His father was a general, and he came out of the army, went into the police force, married a young doctor, and my series starts after she and their unborn baby have been killed in a car crash. So he comes complete with scar on his face and a lot more scars inside. So the books are more or less about Kelso's development and relationships on the way. And Deadfall, he has found a lovely girlfriend who has moved in with him. And she is a young advocate in the Scottish Bar. So there's a very much a legal dimension there as well.
Okay. And have you used your legal experience for that?
Well, yes, it's certainly a great help when you were dealing with courts and so on. And I do actually have a son and daughter-in-law who are advocates in Scotland, and the criminal defence. So I had this wonderful idea that I'd just get all my crimes from my son, you know, come on, come up with some good plots. and he just laughed and he said, criminals don't work the way criminals do in books. He said, they mostly just lose their temper and lash out without any forethought at all. So he's really been no help. He's occasionally has a good story. I mean, you know, one of his clients went to do a bank robbery, you know, the whole mask over the face bit, went up to the cash desk. And as he got there, he realized that the woman on the other side of the cash desk was someone he knew, and she was absolutely terrified.
Oh, gosh.
So what did he do? He pulled up his mask and said, "It's all right, Margaret, it's only me." So, unfortunately, he got 8 years for that, which seemed harsh, since he was clearly as soft in the heart as he was in the head.
Oh, that's brilliant. What a great story. So, without giving too much away, can you tell us a little bit as to what happens in Deadfall?
Well, the sort of prompt for the thing was I'd been so interested of late with all the World Wide Web, World Wide Web, about the way trees communicate and the relationships they have with each other. So I wanted to set a book in a wood forest sort of thing. So I was thinking, whereabouts in Scotland you got that sort of wood? So the Black Isle had always rather intrigued me. I never really knew why it was called the Black Isle, but apparently it's because the soil is very, very rich, and so a lot of things grew there in their dark, rich soil. So they have great woodlands and so on. So I went up to do a spell of research, and it fascinated me. I was walking through this wood, and I looked, and there was a little stream running beside the path. Black, absolutely black. And, you know, little streamlets, and you looked, and in fact there's a point in the book when my young detective constable is in the wood in bad weather, and she looks down, and all these little rivulets look like black snakes creeping across her path. So I was intrigued by that. And then in our garden, we had a tree that wasn't looking as healthy as it might. So we called in a tree surgeon. And by this stage, I'd been reading about how trees are set up. And he said, I'll cut it back for you. And then I had to stand and watch as he sort of hacked limbs off this tree. And, you know, I could almost hear it screaming.
Oh.
He said, no, don't worry. And I said, but will he ever grow back? And he said, no, it's all right. Just wait. Come the spring. And I thought, it will take years before it's the right size again. And to my amazement, it actually sprang into leaf like I'd never seen it afterwards.
Oh, wow.
And I almost wouldn't be able to tell. But I capitalized on my reaction of the horror of seeing a tree cut. So that appears in the book as well as part of the setup. And of course, trees can be very, very valuable. In fact, there's a $1 million tree which actually, you know, you can cut and sell. So that becomes quite a good motive if you're valuable trees and you want to protect them. So the black ebony is the tree, and that too gives you a dimension about what can happen when there's property like that.
Oh, fantastic. So how long did it take you to put the book together? Do you have ideas ready to go, or...?
Well, I had quite a lot of ideas there ready to go, but it was about 15 months. We've had a building extension and writing with earphones to block out the drilling as the ship breaks was not easy.
No.
So it was 15 months rather than a year, which it usually is.
Mm. Oh, well done. So do you know how many there's going to be in the series? Is that planned out?
Well, I've got another one sort of on the way, but it's not planned out. And I tend to have several ideas, but once I settle on one, I'm never quite sure where it's going to go. I hope I know where it will end, but I'm certainly not sure. I'm really telling myself a story. And I've never been a great one for planning out ahead, because I've got a nasty feeling I might get bored. if I know what's going to happen, and often I guess what's going to happen, but it's not set in stone.
Yes, yeah. So it's nice that it's important for you to enjoy the writing process, isn't it?
Yes, so. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, if people want to get a copy of Dead Fall, it's out now and available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Aline Templeton, who we've been chatting with today. Aline, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Talk Radio Europe.
Your voice in Spain.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to the second half of tonight's book show. In the first hour, we were chatting with Ferdi Alenan, Nina Saville and Aline Templeton. In this hour, we'll be joined by Jade Beer, an award-winning editor, journalist and novelist whose latest book, The Palace Dressmaker, is perfect for anyone missing the crown. It's a moving and unforgettable story of a missing husband, a dress once owned by Princess Diana, and the woman who made it. We also chat to Helen Hawkins, who's a writer, editor and English teacher. Her first novel was shortlisted for Penguin's Christmas Love Story competition. Her new novel, A Concert for Christmas, is a celebratory journey into the charm of the festive season. The book draws upon Helen's love of musical theatre, community choirs and her perspective as a school teacher. It's set in the fictional Cotswolds town of Cranswell. We chat to Amy Pollock, who was a teacher for over four decades. She raised three children and loves to play with her seven grandchildren. The Adventures of Jelly Bean, followed by the Further Adventures of Jelly Bean, is about a young girl whose life is always changing and how she adapts to these changes. finally, joining us is Deborah Fowler, who has published over 600 short stories and 15 novels. She lives just outside St. Ives, and A St. Ives Christmas Mystery is the first in a new series set against the beautiful backdrop of the West Cornish coastline. It's about a holiday let cleaner who has access to dark secrets, dirty laundry, and the odd dead body to clean up. Is tonight's book show.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Treat yourself in words unspoken, live your life.
Joining us on the line now is Jade Beer. She's an award-winning editor, journalist and novelist who's with us on The Book Show to talk about her new novel, The Palace Dressmaker. Perfect for anyone missing The Crown. It's a moving and unforgettable story of a missing husband, a dress once owned by Princess Diana and the woman who made it. Welcome to The Book Show, Jade.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. So tell us a little bit about your kind of bridal background. I was really interested to read that you've been on like 30 honeymoons courtesy of Brides magazine. And I thought, I have to ask her about that.
Yes, that was definitely one of the major perks of the job. So I was the editor of Condé Nast Brides magazine for about 8 years. And it was one of those strange kind of career things where I was hired to do a maternity cover. The editor was off having a baby and I was just going to go in and do 6 months or so, and kind of 8 years later was still there. And it was the most joyous job because we were sent wedding cake every day and you got to go to the most incredible bridal fashion shows all around Europe and in New York. So it was great, actually. And it was brilliant preparation because I spent quite a lot of time interviewing designers and watching those shows and, you know, in their ateliers and workrooms. So it's probably, almost certainly what kind of sparked the idea for the book. Not that I sort of realised it then, but I'm sure the sort of seeds were being sown over those years.
Yeah, nice. It's amazing how much of a, well, billion-dollar industry weddings are now. You know, I remember myself, I got married in 2017, and anything that you wanted to buy or order, if you stick the word wedding in front of it, they add a couple of zeros on. I mean, it's huge, isn't it, the money that can be made.
It's an incredible business because I think social media has opened up so many more ideas. And, you know, there's a lot of pressure on couples, I guess, to live up to the last wedding that they attended. Or, you know, you tend to find that once a friend gets married, there's that slight domino effect within the friendship group. So you end up having lots of people from the same friendship group marry over the same sort of couple of years. And I think there's massive pressure on them to try and deliver something that's kind of more fabulous than what went before. But I have to say, the weddings that I covered in those years, some of the most beautiful ones were the ones that just happened in people's back gardens, you know, where the mother of the bride cooked the food and they all sat under the apple tree that the, you know, bride played in as a child. Those weddings that were very pared back were honestly some of the most beautiful that we ever featured, I think. And they're the ones that sort of stick in my memory anyway. So, but yeah, it was a fascinating job. I'm sort of, part of me feels like I'd like to go back and do it all over again.
But oh, yeah.
Well, there's so many wedding photos you can look at, I suppose.
I guess with any of these things, I mean, what makes it is the people. You can spend so much money and have, you know, the best location and the biggest cake and the most expensive dress. But if people are arguing or chucking food at each other or you know.
It's true. And I think I did it myself. On my wedding day, I woke up and I, you know, came down, met the florist, and she sort of said, "Oh, are we sure, like, you know, we haven't put any flowers hanging from the ceiling of the marquee." So in the sort of next 20 seconds, I added another £1,000 to my wedding bill. So I was like, "Oh, yeah, you're right, we haven't got the flowers, enough flowers." So, you know, you sort of do get very wrapped up in it. And but actually what I should have been thinking about was the fact that my grandmother was there, and it was really important that we had photographs taken with her and with my husband's grandparents as well, because not that we knew it at the time, but neither of them are around for much longer. So, yeah. You know, you've always got to have that moment of pause, haven't you, where you just think, okay, what is this day actually about? What is important? What are the memories that I want to carry forward from it? And, you know, inevitably they are not going to be the flowers. They are going to be these precious people Definitely. That are in your life.
Oh, definitely. I remember people saying to me leading up to my wedding day, you know, it goes so quickly. Savor every moment, you know, really be aware of what's going on. And I really made a point of only having like one glass of champagne and one glass of wine or something, because I didn't want to have too much to drink. So I didn't remember it. I was really conscious of that. I wanted to know exactly what was going on at all times.
It's such a good idea. If you're getting married and you have the time to have that lunch the next day, because we did that and it was a really simple thing. It was just a local pub near to the sort of country house where we got married, and everybody kind of reconvened at the pub the next day. And that was so lovely, rather than kind of zipping straight off on the honeymoon, just sort of have that few hours the next day to hear all the stories that you've missed, because they're, you know, that they are typically the best ones, I think.
Yeah, definitely. We did that as well, actually. Had a big lunch on the beach the next day, because lots of people had flown over to Spain, you see. So we wanted to get all the family together, because again, you don't have much of a chance to chat to people on your wedding day. So yeah, that lunch the next day was key.
That next day is often the really enjoyable, relaxed bit as well, because all the formalities are done, the speeches are made, the photographs have all been done, and people just, you can kind of hear the audible sigh of relief, really, and everybody just relaxes, and that's the really fun bit. So yeah, I really loved the next day, actually. It was brilliant right up until the point where we got back to London. This was all sort of happening in the West Country, and we got back to London and realized that all our honeymoon tickets and flight details were still at the wedding venue.
Oh no.
That was less relaxing and sort of prompted a quick emergency trip. But other than that, yeah, good memories.
Oh, goodness. Oh, brilliant. Well, I could sit chatting about our weddings all day, to be honest. But let's talk a bit more about the book. So The Palace Dressmaker, tell us the background for this, because there's various different settings and time period, isn't there?
Yes, it all sort of starts. The first opening scene of the book is set at that very famous kind of Christie's auction that happened in New York in 1997, when Princess Diana's dresses were auctioned off for charity. And it was actually the catalogue that accompanied that auction that I stumbled across, really, online. I wasn't sort of looking for it, but sort of found it one day and thought, okay, that's quite intriguing. I ordered it and started to read about it a little bit. I didn't know anything about the auction at this point, and what was kind of intriguing from a novelist point of view was that there was a discrepancy in the reporting, and some newspapers had referred to 80 dresses that had sold and some referred to 79. And that sort of got me just thinking, OK, why would a dress be pulled from an auction? Because I was sure that all of the dresses listed would have sold, considering who they belonged to. So once the catalogue arrived, I realised it was a simple kind of admin thing, and that dress number 13 was never actually listed in the catalogue. It was a simple kind of, you know, I assumed that perhaps people wouldn't bid on a dress that was number 13. But by that point, it got me thinking, you know, what might happen to this missing dress? If it had been pulled from the auction, where would it be now? Would it be in a different part of the world? Who would own it? What kind of impact might it be having on somebody else's life? So the book opens with that sort of very famous scene. And then the action shifts quite quickly to the almost present day. So it's 2018 in Bath in the West Country. And we're introduced to a kind of cast of characters who all have their own apartment in this one beautiful Georgian townhouse on one of the most incredible terraces within the city. So they all live in the same building, but they're all living quite isolated and private lives, you know, apart from a sort of nod in the hallway in the morning. Nobody really knows each other. And it's the newest resident, Jane, who has recently moved into the building, who is going to change that. She has a kind of chance meeting with the oldest resident in the building, who's a lady called Meredith. And she realises pretty quickly, once she's inside Meredith's apartment, that all is not well, and it's very chaotic, and it's very disordered, and it's dirty, and the shutters haven't been opened for what seems like weeks, and you've got fruit rotting in the fruit bowl. And something is clearly wrong in Meredith's life, and she confesses to Jane at this point she doesn't know where her husband is, she doesn't know where her daughter is. But in that initial meeting, Jane discovers this incredible evening gown, which appears to have just been tossed over the back of a chair in Meredith's bedroom. And with it is a letter that kind of explains that this dress is a gift from Princess Diana. Wow. And Meredith, again, has absolutely no idea why she's in possession of this dress. So what then starts is a kind of road trip, if you like. And what Jane is going to uncover fairly quickly is that Meredith played an intrinsic part in the making of not just that gown, but several of the gowns that Princess Diana wore. And she then takes Meredith on a sort of road trip to all the locations where Diana would have worn those dresses. And it starts to become clear fairly quickly to Jane, if not to Meredith, that she was involved in the making of these dresses. And when she gets back to these locations where the dresses were worn, memories are starting to come back to her. And she starts to recall details of not just how she made the dresses and her professional life, but also details of her private life as well. So, yeah, we see them go to places like the Royal Albert Hall, Kensington Palace. You know, there are scenes that happen in Leicester Square where dresses would have been worn to film premieres. And it, I have to say, it was great fun to research because I sort of had to retrace a lot of those locations myself. I find it much easier to write about something if you've actually placed yourself in the setting. And that's probably my sort of journalistic background, I suppose, because I've always reported on things in that way rather than the more creative writing side of things. So it was wonderful to just walk through all the different locations that Diana would have worn these dresses. There are 10 dresses that feature in the book, and they're all designed by Catherine Walker. And so, yeah, it's a really love-filled road trip that the two of them go on together.
Oh, how nice. So is, I assume obviously the character of Meredith isn't based on Catherine Walker. Is there any kind of connection there, or is it just the fact that it's her dresses?
Yeah, Meredith, we will come to discover, was a seamstress working for Catherine Walker. So okay. While she was a seamstress, her husband, William, was a pattern cutter. So as we're seeing the two of them retrace the steps where the dresses were worn, we also have flashbacks in the book to Meredith at the time when these dresses were being made. So you see her in her kind of younger years making the dresses, and then you see her in her older years. What Jane discovers fairly quickly is that she is living with dementia. She's really struggling because there are no members of the family with her. And it's really up to Jane, who's kind of battling her own insecurity. She's a character who has almost sort of crushing lack of self-confidence, but she has to put aside everything that's going on in her own life in order to step in and not just personally help Meredith, but she's got to motivate everybody else in the building to help her. It's not something she can do by herself because of the level of care and help that Meredith needs. So she has to really motivate the whole community within that townhouse to come together, which eventually they do.
Nice. And with regards to dementia, did you have to do a bit of research into that and into like the symptoms and how they would manifest and things?
I did. I mean, it sort of started with reading around the subject. There's a brilliant memoir by Wendy Mitchell, who was somebody who was sadly passed away now, but had lived with dementia for several years and wrote so brilliantly about it. So it sort of started there, and I was very lucky to have a lot of help from Dementia UK. I worked very closely with them, and they were so brilliant because they were able to sort of furnish me with lots of examples of how dementia can, you know, people assume it's a loss of memory, and of course it is in many cases, but it can be a real rewriting of someone's personality. And so they were able to help really with a lot of real life examples of the kinds of things that were going on. So I worked with their head of research, they're a brilliant woman called Karen Harrison Denning. And, you know, she would tell me things like, there was a woman that she worked with who was living with dementia. She would do things like, she'd get up in the morning and she'd understand that she needed to wash her hair, but she would go through the process of washing her hair without getting it wet. And there was this sort of break in the sequencing. So she understood she needed to get in the shower. She understood there would be shampoo involved, but she couldn't remember that she needed to get her hair wet first. And there was another example of a woman again who was living with dementia, and she would quite often forget that she'd put food on to cook. And so rather than trying to boil an egg for her lunch and let the saucepan, you know, kind of boil dry, she would put the eggs into a kettle and put the kettle on. Of course, the kettle kind of pings off after 3 minutes and the eggs would be cooked. And so there were lots of sort of everyday examples that they were able to help with, which really helped to bring Meredith's experience to life. And I sort of coupled that with my own observations from my grandmother's life. She lived with dementia for several years before she died. And that, I mean, it was very sad at times having to sort of revisit those memories. And
and
I could sort of really connect with this idea of how someone's personality is rewritten, because, you know, my grandmother's dementia started with very sort of simple examples, like she would tell us about how she would wave out of her kitchen window to a man in a house behind hers and how he would wave back. And, you know, there was never a man waving back. There was never a house that backed onto hers. And yet she would stand at her kitchen window and wave to somebody. Mm-hmm. And she would, you know, she would do a lot of things like that. She would introduce you to people who were not in the room and could never have been in the room. But as it developed, as her dementia developed, she became quite spiteful in later years. And that was incredibly hard for my family to deal with, particularly my mum, who was her main carer.
Yeah.
So we see elements of that in the book as well. You know, it's not a simple loss of memory. It is about living with somebody who in many respects does not resemble the person that you know them to be.
Mm.
So that's sort of what I like to do in a lot of my books, take this very, very glamorous backdrop and then place into it a very real and very relatable situation, you know, which will be, you know, it might be about loneliness or heartbreak or deep insecurity. But I like those two things to really butt up against each other.
Yeah. And creating something for everyone, a bit of light and shade.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Palace Dressmaker, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio. It's by Jade Beer, who we've been chatting with today. Jade, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Joining us on the line now is Helen Hawkins. She's a writer, editor and English teacher. Her first novel was shortlisted for Penguin's Christmas Love Story competition and highly commended in last year's I Am in Print romance competition. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, A Concert for Christmas. It's a celebratory journey into the charm of the festive season and draws upon Helen's love of musical theatre, community choirs and her perspective as a school teacher. It's set in the fictional Cotswold town of Cranswell. Welcome to the book show, Helen.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. So this sounds like quite a kind of personal book for you, because it's about a lot of things that you love.
Yes, I didn't set out for it to be, but I think because it was the first book that I wrote and finished, I think it kind of accidentally turned into a book of all of the things that I love.
Yeah, brilliant. So how long have you been a school teacher for?
Gosh, so I've been teaching in a secondary school for, I want to say 15 years now.
Wow.
So yeah, a long time.
Yeah. And what do they think of you being an author?
It's been fab, actually. So lots of the older children, sort of year 10 and 11, have brought the book, and they've come in and asked me to sign it. And we did a little author talk in the library, which was quite nice. And then a couple of teachers also have kind of left things in my pigeonhole to sign and that sort of thing for Christmas presents. So yeah, everyone's been super supportive. It's been lovely.
Really nice. So tell us about your love of singing and musical theatre and what you do in your spare time.
So I've always loved musical theatre. My dad is a massive musical theatre fan. So my childhood car journeys were like the soundtrack was Barbra Streisand and Broadway musicals and all that sort of thing. So I've always loved it. And it was only when I found Abingdon Operatic Society that I kind of jumped in and had a go at doing it myself. I didn't do it until I was about 30. So it was one of those things where I sort of turned up and braved it, really. But I love it. I've been doing it for 10 years now, and we're in a show. I'm in a show pretty much once every 6 months or once every year.
Wonderful.
And yeah, it's fantastic. I love it.
And is that a musical theatre show or singing in a choir?
It's musical theatre, but I've also been in lots of choirs over the years. We've had a staff choir in a couple of the different schools I've been in, and a few singing groups and that sort of thing. But yeah, the Abingdon Operatic Society is always musical theatre. We've just finished Guys and Dolls.
Oh, so, wonderful.
Yeah, lots of fun.
Yeah. I mean, it must be tricky doing the rehearsals for that as well as the school teaching and everything else.
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm a creature of habit. I'm quite good at routine. And I think if I didn't have routine, I don't think I'd get any of the things that I love doing done. So, yeah.
So tell us about the characters in your book.
So the main character is a girl called Sophie. She's not dissimilar to myself, although that wasn't the plan. It just kind of happened accidentally. And she is a primary school teacher in a Cotswold village, so in a little tiny school. And she's, you know, not had much joy when it comes to love and relationships. And so she's moved to this small town and has thrown herself into her teaching and into running and coordinating a Christmas concert with a local village choir, which is made up of an eclectic mix of kind of community characters, if you like. And just when she thinks things are kind of settling down and she's getting into the swing of things, the musical director disappears and is replaced by a man called Liam Hawthorne, who is the opposite of Sophie. Sophie loves Christmas. She's happy. She's excited about things. She throws herself into stuff. Whereas Liam is very anti-Christmas. Now, he has his reasons, but she doesn't realise that to begin with. And so the enemies to lovers trope is born. And so in the end, they have to work together to try and get the Christmas concert off the ground. And the story is kind of that journey and those adventures that they have in the lead up to the Christmas concerts.
Yeah, great. So why in the Cotswolds?
So I live in the Cotswolds. Those people that know me who have read the book have gone, is it actually this place? And is this the village hall that you're talking about? And the answer is yes. It's kind of a montage of lots of the places that are near to me. And also, I just think the Cotswold is such a lovely place for a Christmas book. Like, it is incredibly festive at this time of year. So
nice. And how much planning did you do before you started writing the book?
In terms of this book, not very much planning. Actually, the idea came, it was just a real small moment that stuck in my mind. And I was like, I've got to write this book. My friend went on a disastrous first date. And basically, the story emerged out of the story that she told me. So in terms of planning for this book, it kind of all came, the first draft came very quickly. I had to do lots of working on it. And so that involved lots of post-it notes stuck to my office wall and moving things around. So the planning almost came after the hideous first draft. And yeah, that was when a lot of the thinking had to happen, because I just needed to get the story out in the first place. And yeah. I sort of worked on it from there.
Would your friend mind if you tell us what happened on her disastrous first date?
So she, when she turned up, the guy, it was very sweet. The guy had brought her a gift, but instead of buying her a bouquet of flowers, he bought her a bouquet of helium balloons. Which seems like a lovely idea at the time, but when you then have to kind of manhandle those balloons into a small village pub and attempt to have like a nice conversation with somebody that you've just met, it's quite difficult, apparently.
Yes. I mean, I like the fact that he's done something a bit different. It's definitely a conversation point, but at the same time, it's not very practical, is it?
No, I don't think he'd thought it through, bless him. But it was the thought that counts. She's not with him, needless to say.
Okay.
It didn't go well.
And she doesn't mind that you've kind of used that story and turned it into a book.
No, I've put her in the acknowledgements and she was okay with that.
Nice one. So do you have a bit of a break before starting the next book, or are you straight on to the next one?
So the second book is both books are out in hardback, and the second book is coming out in paperback in February. And actually, I'd written both of them before I got my book deal, because I finished the first one and then I was like, gosh, what do I do with my life now? All of a sudden I had lots of spare time, and writers that I kind of had connected with on social media said, just keep writing. So I kept writing. And so as soon as one book is finished, I start thinking about the next one, and I've got a few now kind of homeless books that are looking for places to be published. So yeah, I just keep writing while the ideas are there.
Yeah,
I feel like it would be foolish not to.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's great. Have you got like a book of ideas then?
Yeah, I wish I could say I do have a book of ideas. What I actually have is bits of paper and notes on my phone and kind of the back of beer mats. It's that kind of planning. When I get serious about an idea, it's very kind of, I'm very meticulous about it. But until that point, it's backs of envelopes. It's that sort of thing, just all over the house.
Yeah. And can you bring a few ideas together? You know, if you've got little ideas, that I suppose one idea doesn't necessarily mean that that's a whole book. It can just be something that happens to a character. So lots of different ideas can end up being in the same book, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. So I usually end up coming up with like a main concept. So in A Concert for Christmas, the big idea was disastrous date leads to her then kind of meeting this same person in a slightly different scenario, and then they fall in love through the Christmas concert. That was the big idea. And then there are lots of other things, you know, subplots and other characters. She's got a best friend. There's like a slightly crazy ex-Hollywood starlet who's also in the choir. So those sorts of things then kind of get woven into that kind of main, I guess, romance arc, really.
Yeah. And yeah. Did it seem an obvious choice for you to write romance novels?
Yes. I've tried for years to write other things. So I've got, you know, a completely finished young adult, witchy kind of historical novel. I've got a novel that I wrote based on my grandfather's history during World War One. And every time I tried to write something kind of serious, if you like, it ended up becoming a romance. And I thought, you know what, maybe I should just write a romance, because that was kind of where my head always went. And so in some ways, yes, it was obvious, but I didn't realise for quite a long time.
Yeah. Oh, the one about your granddad's history sounds interesting, though.
Yes, it was based on, we found an old cigarette case that had kind of, it had been, you know, on the battlefield with him in World War One. And in it, there were some photographs of his friends from that he'd kind of worked with during that time, and a couple of letters. And the letters were from some Jamaican officers who had written to him after the war to say thank you for kind of looking after him, because racism was so rife within that situation, and he kind of taken them under his wing and protected them as much as possible from that, and kind of fought their corner a little bit. So it was a really interesting story.
Yeah.
But I couldn't help but weave a romance into there as well.
Brilliant. Do you think you can go back to it? Because it'll be nice to be published.
So that one was never really finished. It never really, I don't think I ever got over about half a book's length. I think I probably could go back to it, but I'm not sure now is quite the right time, but maybe in the future.
Yeah, it must be difficult, I guess, to go back to something, but when you've got an idea that you, that you'd, you know, really like to take further, but then get stuck, it must be hard to know what to do, know what the right thing to do is.
Yeah, it's incredibly hard as well when you've put so many hours into it. So for that book, I did tons of research and spent hours and hours and hours writing these, you know, tens of thousands of words. So for them to just be in a drawer somewhere is a little bit sad, but
yeah
maybe one day.
Never say never.
Never say never, no.
Well, if people want to get a copy of A Concert for Christmas, it's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Helen Hawkins, who we've been chatting with today. Helen, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been brilliant.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Amy Pollock. She was a teacher for over four decades, raised three children and loves to play with her seven grandchildren. From her own childhood to the classroom and as a parent and grandparent, she's perfectly positioned to pen her coming-of-age book series. The Adventures of Jelly Bean, followed by The Further Adventures of Jelly Bean, first came into being when Amy's fourth grade teacher used to ask her to get up in front of the class and tell the stories about this character she would make up as she went along. Several years later, she started writing these stories down and would work on them periodically in any free time she had during her teaching career and raising her three children. The silver lining of the COVID pandemic for Amy was that she was more or less forced after approximately 60 years to finish her Jelly Bean books. Welcome to the Book Show, Amy.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Hannah. Wow, you got it all completely right. That's amazing.
Lovely to have you with us, and congratulations to have these books out there. It must be so thrilling for you after all these years.
Thank you. No, it is. And my book three should be coming out very soon.
Oh, wonderful stuff. So tell us about Jelly Bean.
So let's see. As you said, I made her up, and the story's about this mischievous forthright fourth grader. As I went along, because my characters usually tell me what they need me to have them do. So it began that way, as you correctly said. And she is the youngest of four in her family. She has three older brothers, which was based loosely on my husband's cousin, who's the only girl in her family and has three older brothers. And she has ups and downs with various family members and with classmates, which is a lot of what makes my book so popular, I think, because most boys and girls go through that in some way, shape, or form. And let's see, she deals with issues of, well, she has a beloved grandparent who passes away. Without giving too much away, she has a dog that she loves who, I don't want to tell too much here. He gets away, but don't worry, that has a good ending. Ups and downs with classmates, sometimes with teachers, and one of the main plot points is, her very, very, very closest friend moves away, and that girl has ups and downs of her own, and it's hard for Jelly Bean when she moves away because she's a loyal, wonderful friend, but her parents would not let her go over to this girl's house, which happens in households because she had kind of been living on the wrong side of the tracks, let's say. So there's that as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting kind of friends and things that she has to deal with, or that the friends are dealing with. Another friend of hers is anorexic, so I imagine there's lots of issues there.
Yes, because that's a fairly common problem these days, and it can be among some of the gymnastics girls, which is what happens here, and how she deals with it and helps this person. And yes, that's another part of it.
Yeah. She also has trouble getting along with one of her brothers.
Yes, the one closest in age to her, and that happens often. And oh, some of that's based on what happened in my household. My daughter's the youngest, and she has two older brothers. I have boy, boy, girl. And they had their various encounters and fights and that kind of thing. So that's in there, which is much to her mother's chagrin. And then there's the grandmother who, well, could she be me? Partially. And she's based on, well, I had two wonderful grandmothers and one who never raised her voice and smoothed a lot of things over. So the grandmother's a lot like that.
Yeah. She also has an uncle who she's really close to, who's about to marry a really awful woman.
Yes. And that can happen. That does happen in many households. And, but that ends up in a better way, farther along in my books.
Yeah.
In my book too. Yes.
So why do you think coming of age stories are so important for children?
I think that a lot of the issues, as I've just been discussing, are so commonplace, but in many cases are really hard to talk about. So in the coming of age stories, I guess I liked writing about that age because things are kind of coming into focus at those ages, 9, 10, 11, and suddenly just things that were happening around you or around a boy or girl that age become come into clearer focus, and you kind of learn how to, well, this is another thing that people like about the book, sort of have to learn how to make your own decisions, which is kind of tough when your parents don't always agree with you. And or some of the things you might decide to do are not acceptable. And I did go through this with a lot of my kids. Well, still am, I have to say.
Yeah.
We don't always agree on what is a good way to proceed.
Yeah. And with your 40-year career in teaching, did you find that the kind of problems that children had, or even the way that they resolved them, changed much in that time?
Oh, that's interesting, given that technology came about and so forth. Well, in some ways, the more things change, the more they stay the same. There's certain problems that are just, or certain issues, let's say, that are just there regardless, because people are people. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say from biblical times till now, with the advent of so much technology, I found in my later years, and this was with teaching college, that a lot of the boys and girls, a lot of my students had trouble letting go of their phones and and their laptops and iPads and so forth. So I did have to say, you know, you have to put all that aside, which was never an issue earlier on. And some of them, let's say one student I'm remembering in particular, would come up and say, I have an emergency. And I'd say, no, you're not supposed to know that you have an emergency. You will find that out after class. And you know, for a lot of them, well, for a lot of adults, I know, I mean, even myself included, it's so tempting to, you know, check your phone or your iPad, you know, 500 times a day, which isn't so terrific, but just kind of how it is now.
Yeah. And the fact that you started the stories so many years ago, coming back to them and eventually getting them done, did you have to do a lot of kind of editing and changing of the original stories?
That's so funny. It's funny you should ask, because, like, for example, well, I give a lot of presentations in many places, schools, libraries, a senior center once, and variety of places, mostly schools. And I went back to the school and I was invited back, which was wonderful, where I had gone And so I was talking about that because the kids always want to ask me that, and the teachers, actually librarians and so forth. And I said, well, for one thing, I had to go through and change a lot of the names, because when I was younger, growing up in the late 50s and 60s, names that were popular then, Kathy, Susan, Patty, Debbie, not so much my name, not so much Amy, but in any event, now they're different. So I had to assign different names to a lot of the characters.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny, but it was a big job.
Yeah. But I mean, you must be so proud and pleased that they're out there now and that you're already on to book three.
Yes. Well, I'm working on my book four, but my book three, because everyone seems to really love a series. And yes, she is going to be getting a little older, but that should be coming out very soon, being published by Pegasus. But I am. And my reviews, which were wonderful, happily, said that, well, some said that my Jelly Bean is a role model, which I was like, wow. You know, I hadn't really planned on or counted on that in particular. I just, you know, she had started out just kind of full of mischief, as my sister and I were kind of growing up. Well, in any event, so I'm happy. And I was talking to my PR person, who's great. And he said, I guess that's because she, you know, nothing in my books is a definite way of thinking about things. And he said, my books make you think.
Yeah.
They open up certain topics that can be difficult to talk about. And there are no very clear, easy answers for a lot of the issues.
Mm-hmm. And it's good books that make you think, particularly for children of this age, because it's likely to encourage them to discuss these subjects with their friends, with their peers, or with their parents and grandparents.
Yes, that is so true. And like I remember in one class, again, when I was teaching college, and we were talking about issues of how difficult it can be for a gay person. And oh, my goodness, some of the comments were surprising. And one of the boys I remember said, well, I don't want to go against my grandmother. Someone else said against my church, what they say is correct. And I'd say, no, I'm not urging you to go up against, you know, I'm just urging you to either of those two, I was going to say, but I'm just encouraging you to think for yourself. Yeah. I don't mean go off and start taking drugs. That's not what I mean at all, but about an important issue. And if you don't agree with someone, such as someone in your church or a grandparent, then try to figure out a way to go that's right for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Good advice. Definitely.
Hard. Yeah.
Well, if people want to get a copy of the first book, The Adventures of Jelly Bean, it's available now on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Amy Pollock, who we've been chatting with today. Amy, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Hannah. Thank you very much.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Deborah Fowler. She's published over 600 short stories and 15 novels. She's also written a number of non-fiction books on subjects such as guides for small business and money management. She lives just outside St. Ives, and a St. Ives Christmas mystery is the first in a new series set against the beautiful backdrop of the West Cornish coastline. In it, you can meet Merrin, a holiday let cleaner in the idyllic St. Ives, who has access to dark secrets, dirty laundry, and the odd dead body to clean up. Welcome to the book show, Deborah.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you with us. So you've done so much writing then. That's incredible. 600 short stories, 15 novels, and some non-fiction books as well. It's obviously kept you busy.
Well, it has. I mean, the short stories started when I was only 17. And I wrote, I suppose, for about 13 years full time. And then children and marriage and stuff came along. And we had a herb farm in Cornwall. And that took up a lot of time. And so it's only in the last sort of 10, 15 years I've actually gone back to it again. I had a big period of no writing at all.
And did it all come back to you quite easily?
Well, it was a bit like sort of oiling an old machine. It took a while. A bit of grinding went on, but yes, it came back. It was lovely, actually, to be able to sit down and start again.
Yeah. So do you feel, having had that gap, do you feel you're bringing something different to your writing that maybe you're like life experience, I guess, that you didn't have before?
Well, I guess so. I mean, being older, obviously, I mean, you know, more happens. The other thing is, I always feel with writing, it's a bit like, you know, you have life's experiences, and you if you think of it like a well, and, you know, you have the well full of things you want to talk about and things that have happened to you which you can put into books. But after a bit, the well gets a bit dry. So I think having a sort of gap is perhaps not such a bad thing.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So this new book, then, it's the start of a new series. Why did you decide you wanted to have a series?
Well, I've had a series before, and also when I used to write short stories, I used to do like serials in women's magazines and things like that. So I quite like getting characters established and then keeping them going, you know, through a series of stories. So I have done a series of four, and this one is a sort of, I suppose you'd describe it as cozy crime. It's some, you know, there's sort of bits of blood, but not too many guts, you know.
Yes.
And, I've sort of got the first one done, which is now published, and then I've almost finished the second one, and it is lovely to be able to pick up on the same characters, and I hope I obviously get to know them better, and I also hope my readers do too, you know.
So who are your recurring characters? Is it the Inspector and Merrin?
Yes, those are the two main characters. There are sort of a few locals who recur, and then Chief Inspector Pepiet has his own sort of sergeant called Jack Eddy. He recurs in it as well.
Okay. So tell us a bit about Merrin, first of all.
Well, she was at university in Bristol. She comes originally from St Ives in Cornwall, but she went to Bristol University and she read law, and there she met another law student. He became a policeman and she became a family lawyer, and they married. But when the first book begins, he has been shot and killed, and so she decides to go back to St Ives because she just can't bear sort of staying in their home where she's been for sort of, you know, she's in her 50s, so she's been there for about 30 years. And they have one child who's at Oxford. So she goes back to St Ives, and that's really how the story begins, with her new life in Oxford.
Mm. And how is it that she decides to be a cleaner?
Well, she doesn't really. She comes back to St Ives, but she's got a best friend called Clara from her, you know, from her sort of nursery school upwards. And Clara has a restaurant and two holiday lets, and the holiday let woman lets her down, who does the cleaning. And Merrin is extremely undomesticated and so does the cleaning. But in the process of doing the cleaning, she stumbles across this dead body one day.
Mm. So what about the Inspector Pepiat? What's he like?
Well, he's had a broken marriage, but he's still friends with his wife, and they have two children. She lives in Falmouth, and but he's a sort of slightly lonely character. Very good at his job. Gets involved. I mean, he's based in Truro, but he gets involved in this dead body in St Ives, because a dead body in St Ives is a big deal down here. We don't have very many of them, I'm glad to say. And so he gets involved, and that's how he meets Merrin. And there's no romance or anything at the moment, though. Give it a few books, and there could be. You know, he's a sort of slightly dour character, finds it difficult to express his emotions. Well, not unlike a lot of men, really, you know, and but a good chap.
Yes. So we, as readers, we'll like them both, you think?
Yeah, I sincerely hope so, yes. I mean, they've got their flaws, but then so have we all, you know.
Yeah.
So I hope they will.
So do you spend quite a lot of time planning out the characters and trying to understand them before you write about them?
Yes, I mean, the characters for me are very important. I mean, writing crime's a funny thing. I mean, if you take somebody like Colin Dexter and Morse, I mean, he planned everything down to the last jot, you know, of what was going to happen. Whereas you take somebody like Agatha Christie, and she used to get everybody together at the end of the book with Poirot or whoever, and then pick the most unlikely person and then work backwards and put the bus telling cables right or whatever she had to do to make the villain the villain. I'm somewhere sort of in between. The characters are very important, and I try to be as baffled as my inspector for as long as possible, because I feel if he's baffled and I'm baffled, then there's a jolly good chance that the reader will be too.
Mm. So you don't know who it is at the beginning then? You like to surprise yourself?
Yes. No, we work it out together as we go along.
Nice. So with regards to the plot, do you do much planning with that? Obviously not the ending and who done it, but or do you just have a kind of an idea of the characters and then start writing?
I have a sort of general theme as to how it's going to end up. I mean, certainly in this book I've just written, I really actually didn't know until I got quite near the end exactly who did what to whom and why.
Mm.
As I say, I feel that's better, you know, because I think it must be quite annoying for a reader if they can see how it's going to pan out quite near the beginning.
Yeah. And with regards to the series, obviously you've decided from the start it's going to be a series. Do you know how many there's going to be, or do you not plan that?
Well, that's very much up to the publisher. I mean, she says this first one is doing well, and, you know, if the next one does well, then hopefully we'll crack on. You know, I'd very much like to. I think because, you know, the last series I did, we went to 8 books, and it's just a question of really whether the publisher's finding, you know, that it's doing well enough to justify it.
Yeah, exciting. Well, if people want to get a copy of A St. Ives Christmas Mystery, it's the first in a new cosy crime series. People can get it from our website, tre.radio. It's by Deborah Fowler, who we've been chatting with today. Deborah, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for including me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.